The Marginal Gains Podcast is brought to you by Soka, creators of the finest pumps and tools for bicycles.
We're also sponsored by Shimano, creators of the finest components and brakes for bicycles. And not to be overlooked is the fact that Shimano, under its Pro Bike gear line, makes fantastic handlebars, seat posts, stems, and a ton of other bike building necessities that meet many of the marginal gains we talk about on this show. So to round out your next build, be sure to check out pro-bikegear.com.
All right, Fatty, this is a show I know you in particular have been anticipating. And I think we all got pretty excited when we saw this guest headlined in the title of the episode. He is one of the most important American bike racers of all time, and he's next on Marginal Gains. This is the Marginal Gains Podcast, the show that makes a big deal about the little things and how those little things can be a big deal. I'm Hottie.
And I am Fatty. And there is a lot to say about Josh's guest for this episode, but he can best be described by a date and a place. June 5th, 1988, on the Gavia in Italy. The race, the Giro d'Italia, the rider, Andy Hampston.
Josh talks with Andy about the early days of this legend's career. But the crux of their conversation is that iconic stage, that iconic ride, and Andy's bold move to grab the Maglia Rosa.
Andy Hampston a 8 secondi, quindi Hampston conquista la maglia rosa. E ora vediamo il gruppetto degli inseguitori.
All right, Marginal Gains fans, we have a super exciting one today. I know I feel like I say this with all of our guests, but I think I mean it even more so than normal on this one. This one of my absolute all-time heroes and lifelong marginal gainer himself, Andy Hampston, is with us today. Andy, thank you so much for joining us. This is super exciting.
Thanks, Josh. This will be fun. It's good to join you, especially when I can just stay at home and join you.
Yeah, the crazy technology, right? It's like the world has changed it's been changing, and then it changed all of a sudden on us.
Yeah, that's for sure.
although as we just found out over the last 10 minutes, it still doesn't always work right. Even though it feels like we do this all day, every day, like, and then sometimes it just doesn't connect.
You still have to cross your fingers like in the old
exactly.
days.
I always feel like a tiny accomplishment in my day if I can get a three-way call or a Zoom meeting done without a pet or, some drop. So, Andy, I mean, thinking back, you know, I think you were, you know, the Americans going into Europe more so than the Europeans who were there. But, I mean, you guys were bringing new ways of thinking, technology, I mean, just a new mindset to the European pro scene. And this to me culminates a little bit with your Landshark that, I think we can get to here in a bit. But take that all the way back. Tell me what got you into the sport in the first place and kind of how that early part of your career went.
Josh, I just liked to ride my bike when I was a teenager. I guess I got my first 10 speed in 1972 when I was 12 years old I can't do math right now. I guess when I was 10 years old, I started just riding my bike everywhere. When I was 12 years old, I probably got my first 10 speed. And I just loved riding around to visit friends. There was a group of cyclists with a great little bike shop in town called Nomad Bike Shop. And every evening they'd do a little ride and invite anyone in the town of Grand Forks that showed any interest. So there'd be 6 to 8 of us any given evening. And it was just fun. It was fun to explore. We'd do longer rides on weekends, getting up to 100 miles a ride. And I started touring in that same time, riding for 2 or 3 days to some cool spot, just crashing a few of us into a hotel or cheapest motel we could possibly find. One of, there seemed to be an adult that was riding their bikes with us. my brother Steve and I and other friends would just go ride, go look for hills in North Dakota. I was doing a few races a year those years. And that was fascinating, but, you know, it's hard to base all my love of cycling doing three races a year. I just like everything to do with bikes, working on them in the long winters, but certainly riding them as much as I can. But racing was really fun. I wasn't the best when I started racing, but I really liked doing it. And when I was 15, my family spent the summer in England where we have relatives. So there I was able to hang out in an English bike shop in Cambridge and find out that it's bike racing's an actual sport. There's professionals doing it, mostly in Europe, but also South America. And, you know, it was cool to be part of that world, but I didn't think, even though I was racing in England, doing time trials and a few criteriums, and actually watching professionals race in the afternoons after I did my early morning stint with the schoolboys, you know, I never thought I'd be a professional, but I thought, that is so cool. They're paid to ride their bikes all day long.
Seems like the ultimate, right? Especially when you're a teenager. Wait a minute, I could make money doing this?
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, I remember saying to my brother, wouldn't it be great just to be the worst professional on the whole planet? Like, just barely make it, but get paid to do it all the time and have people helping you. So I was always interested in it, but I did really like competing in bike racing. I liked the tactics. I wasn't a fast sprinter. I didn't think I had any natural ability to win the races, but I loved doing it. So I loved, you know, when I got dropped, well, why did I get dropped? You know, what can I do to figure out how to get stronger? And back then, for training back then, when I was a mid-teenager, we would just ride our bikes. There's a 25-mile loop. There's a 35-mile. You know, if we wanted to stick to pavement, we had very limited options in North Dakota where to ride. I remember once with my friend who was the same age as I was, Nikki, I said, you know, it's weird. In the races, I'm fine until they go really fast, those attacks. You know, they attack and it takes me forever to catch up. And then when I catch up, I'm fine because I can sit on the wheel. I can always keep up with whoever I'm with. And we thought, well, what if when we were riding, instead of just riding 25 miles as fast as we can and sprint on the overpass and at the city limit sign, what if we went super, super, super fast, even if we had to slow down after a little while and catch our breath, and then go super, super, super fast later, kind of like a race? We thought, man, that's brilliant. But, you know, we never got around to doing it. We were kids.
That's great. Well, and it was a different era, right? We didn't have information at the time. I mean, information was hard to come by.
No. Yeah, Eddie B, well, he was hired. He helped the American junior team wasn't it the Junior Worlds in 77 in Washington, D.C. And that was the first thing I ever read about in America of, you know, a real coach, cycling, coach, training, working with anyone. And they got a bronze medal in the team time trial. And that was just, that opened the door from, wow, wish I could run across Eddie B, which I did the next year. I bet there were coaches, you know, there were good clubs, especially in the Midwest and the East Coast and the Bay Area and probably LA. But I don't know if they did anything other than just riding together and sprinting for town signs together.
Interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned the bike shops a lot, and I think that's a subject that has come up on this show quite a bit. You know, I think it's just good to remind ourselves the inherent value of the bike shop, right? And I think in this online age, it's so easy to go to the internet, buy stuff, get your information. But man, the bike shop historically had been such a hub of information, connection, right? Mentorship.
And how to ride. It was, you know, meet at the bike shop at 5 o'clock in the summer. They're closing up. Everyone's, you know, fill up your water bottles and let's go on a bike ride. And they taught us kids how to stay on the wheel. And I remember, you know, we probably said, oh, don't tell me what to do. I just want to ride my bike. Well, you know, you need to learn how to draft. I don't want to have to call your mom and tell her I left you out by Merrifield 3 hours ago. You have to learn how to ride. And, you know, I'm realizing now when I work, I'm able to do bicycle tours for people. So I get riders of all ability, people who've been riding forever like us and people who just got into riding recently. And it's fun to seeing all these abilities, but I realize how fortunate I was to be in the sport in the 70s and have people, they weren't all guys, but often men, tell me how to ride. Because, and part of it was, look, you need to, you know, this is how you sit on a wheel. When you feel stronger, pull through in the little pace line. But here's the huge list of don'ts, and it's all about safety. Don't knock me over, because I'm going to be really mad. My skin doesn't repair as well as yours. And, you know, it was like kindergarten. They taught me everything I needed to know, or 90% of what I needed to know as a pro racer, I learned in those first few years from other riders who were just really nice. They were kind in offering all their experience on how to ride in a group, you know, to not leave me out somewhere flapping in the prairie, but also how to communicate with them and how we should ride as a group. And, you know, that's something that, you know, now I see there's some clubs, there's a Rafa store here in Boulder, and they seem to, you know, invite people along. Let's go ride together. The last 2 years, it's kind of hard to do group rides. Mm-hmm. But at least there's a bit more of that club atmosphere. And I know there are a lot of other clubs around the country, but I think that's something that's really been phased out, probably because people aren't meeting at bike shops as much as buying stuff on the internet and just going out on a bike ride. And
yeah, I mean, I feel like I've seen through COVID, and I think we've talked about it a couple times on the show, you know, like our accountant, just fell in love with cycling through COVID. It was something he could do. And in the last few months, you know, he's been trying to show up on some rides. And of course, he doesn't know what to do. And people are kind of like, you know, get out of our ride. You're messing things up. And, you know, that really frustrates me. Like, I want to see that mentorship. I want to see people bringing, bringing those new people into the sport, rather than just telling them to, you know, go learn to ride. Like, no, let's help them learn to ride. Let's you know, help them with those safety aspects, because it's so important.
Yeah, which is hard, you know, because it's everyone's short, precious time to ride a bike, and you just I found certainly with my groups that it's pretty easy just to start saying, look, we've all been beginners. You know, now I'm the experienced one. When I was a kid, this is what people said to me, you know, don't knock me over. Let's ride safely. And here's some things we can do to, you know, focus on where to look, how to communicate when we're riding our bikes together and not knock each other over. And it takes a certain amount of generosity in a group to accept someone new, but also give them instructions. You know, it's hard for adults to tell other adults what to do, or certainly do it in a nice way, but it's very generous when people do.
You know, you guys, you racing as a teenager, and you said you meet Eddie B the next year. So I'm assuming that's national team time. and you're in, right? So what year roughly is this?
Good question. This must be December of 81. He invited about 60 juniors to the Olympic Training Center, and during our Christmas holiday break for must have been a week, maybe a bit more. So I got an invite because I was fourth in the national time trial the previous summer. Flew down, had a really great time, got to hang out with other kids that were just there to ride their bikes. Met with Eddie B. You know, got coaching, but the first thing he told us was, you should all have coaches. America's so backwards. You know, I know there are other coaches than me, but, you know, I have a PhD in physiology, basically to coach cycling. But what you need to do, you know, always look for a coach, but learn how to coach yourselves. You know, I'll help you as much as I can, but I'm also, you know, it's tricky because he's also the national selector. We all want to go to the world championships and be on the national team. But he was really smart. He said, you know, you're all kids, just you're all pretty nice, but be polite and go up at an appropriate moment. Go up to, you know, probably an older racer. It's good to talk to your peers, but go to the older racers, not immediately after a race, but ask them one or two questions and really, you know, so think about what you're going to ask. So I would ask people, you know, I wasn't a good sprinter, but I'd ask someone who was, you know, I'm not a good sprinter, what should I do? And just got the best advice, you know, just like I just said, just when you start sprinting, just focus on the finish line. Never look behind you, never look down between your legs or under your arm. Just accelerate all the way to the finish line and don't be distracted with what other people are doing. So he gave us great tips. I was able to, I wasn't able to go to the invite for the next trip. That must have been in the spring because I was in school. So in the summer, I think it was going to be the National Sports Festival was a really fun mini Olympics for that all Olympic sports participated in. And they were going to have the junior trials for the world championships that fall there. But I wasn't able to go to whatever training camp in March. So he said, well, we have a couple spots open for kids who do something exceptional, but, you know, we're only inviting so many kids and you have to do something really good. So I got second on Memorial Day weekend in two senior races in Moline, Illinois and Muscatine, Iowa. And that impressed them enough for me to get an invite back to whatever summer camp or the sports festival in the summer. Then I, you know, made the national team that year and ended up being able to go to the Junior World Championships in Argentina, which was super fun. Yeah, Eddie B changed it. I mean, he flipped it, I think, for certainly everyone my age and younger, or, you know, even 10 years older than I was.
Yeah, no, I think he like you said, he professionalized it. He changed the thinking. He, you know, he established the sport as a more than a sport, I guess. Right. And the coach, you know, I think after that,
he made sure that the national teams would always go, sometimes two teams at a time would go compete in Europe in the top races. He's the grandfather.
The grandfather. So it's so true. It's so true. So you're having the success as a junior and eventually you make the leap to professional. Like how did that happen for you?
I was an amateur for over 4 years after, you know, I was very good. I got a bronze and a silver medal at the Junior World Championships in the team trial. So I was very good. I was on the national team when I was a senior, an amateur, I guess I should say. Competing in Europe, having some successes, won a nice prologue of a race in Italy when I was 19, but, you know, not making the Olympic team, again, not being a sprinter, I wouldn't be selected for many of the top races. I'd do the world championships when they'd be in Europe. I was able to do the Tour de l'Avenir, the William Tell race is a very good amateur race in Switzerland. And a lot of races, sometimes in the off season, but a lot of races in South and Central America, where I also learned a lot and had a really good introduction to competing with South Americans, but the Colombians were the standouts. And the Coors Classic, did that every year once I was an amateur. And that was my international stage to shine or to fail, but to go head to head with certainly the best American racers, but the best South American racers, and the Mexicans would come up with a very good team, and eventually pretty good professional teams great professional teams with varied amounts of motivation would come over to do the race. But that was my real introduction to going elbow to elbow with professionals. And then when I was in 1985, I had a 1 month contract to race the tour of Italy with 7-Eleven. My Levi's Raleigh team released me for 1 month to go race in Italy with 7-Eleven. And that was my big chance to turn professional. But it wasn't that I could stay on the 7-Eleven team. I knew during that race that I had to impress some people and join a European pro team, which was my goal. And that ended up working out pretty well.
Yeah, I'll say. But so that's interesting. I didn't realize that first Giro for you was on a was that common at the time?
No, it was very uncommon. But Michael Facca was the manager of the Levi's Raleigh team, and he wanted us to turn professional, but didn't have the budget. But he had really good contacts in Europe and was able to talk to the UCI, explaining the situation. And the UCI made an exception for some little classification. They put the U.S. as a small or an underdeveloped cycling country, that we could have flexibility that amateurs, a racer could go from an amateur American team, race professionally for a different team in Europe, but come back to their amateur team in America because they would be the star rider most likely of that team. And if that one or two riders, star riders left the team, that whole amateur team might collapse. And because America was pretty much pro-am racing, like on 7-Eleven, we had professionals and amateurs. It didn't really matter in America, but it certainly did in the eyes of the UCI. They made that exception. So the next year when I joined La Vie Claire, in 1986, I was able to race for Levi's in the United States, but race for La Vie Claire in the rest of the world. And don't know if that lasted very, very much longer, but it worked out well. And I could bring to La Vie Claire other amateur riders like Roy Nickman and Thurlow Rogers could go race for La Vie Claire in Europe, but not have, it was probably more bureaucratic. They didn't have to be registered with more than one team.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So yeah, I actually had no idea of that bit of the history. That's fascinating. And what an opportunity. I mean, that's because you think of that.
Oh, it was great. It was super. Like I was obviously delighted in 86 to go to La Vie Claire because it was the best team in the world. And LeMond and Steve Bauer were on the team and made me feel very welcome. But I didn't, you know, it would have been hard to leave Levi's. I wouldn't have said no, but it was great to keep my American-based team running for them not to lose their sponsorship. But it was super racing for La Vie Claire.
So that's fascinating history, though. I was not aware that was going on. And I mean, I really cannot think of a time since then. I mean, certainly the rules today are crazy about stuff like that. I mean,
I don't know if that fell apart after a little while. I don't know if Colombians were able to take advantage of it. It just sort of a loophole created just so a small team wouldn't fall apart. And I think the exchange between the two continents was fundamental in it being able to work.
Oh, I mean, you look at historically what that did for cycling in this country. I mean, that, you know, obviously LeMond and, you know, was big, but I mean, to think of, you know, the names that you're naming, you know, you and Roy, and I mean, you guys would all go on to have really fantastic careers in Europe as pros, right?
I think it fell in step well with LeMond bashing down the door. He wasn't the first American professional, of course, but he was the one that brought everyone in the cycling public's view of Europe, brought American racers to their attention. So there was a lot of interest in all of us turning whatever American pro could get on a professional team, in Europe ended up being a point of interest to the fans. So it certainly helped me turn pro. Well, he told LaViclaire to sign me because I did well in that 85 Tour of Italy. But it was also a great opportunity for other racers to come later, and certainly for the whole 7-Eleven team a year later to turn professional. I guess the same year that I went to LaViclaire, sorry, but 7-Eleven continued to have their whole program, famously in the Tour de France in 1986.
No, it was an amazing changing time. I think I've told the story on this podcast before, but a soigneur that I'd known forever, James Collione, if you would have crossed paths with him.
Yeah.
But he was, I think at LaViclaire.
He gave me a massage the morning I won Alpe d'Huez.
Oh, really? Oh, that's too funny. So
give him a big shout out.
Goodness. He's one of my just dear friends. I just love him. But James was interesting. And he told me once we were, I think at the Dauphiné with Phonak, or I mean, one of these, this was in more recent times, but he talked about, the Americans coming in, and he said, we just had this feeling of dread that they were going to change everything. And, as Europeans, and I think, he was at Castorama for a bit there. And I think that was the feeling of dread, right, for that team of like looking at, what Le Monde was doing. And, it was interesting to get it from that perspective of, the Americans showing up with a little bit of an attitude of like, well, just because you say that's how it should be, we're going to think a little bit differently, right? Or we're going to do things differently.
So Castorama would have been under Guimard's tight control. We probably should talk about some of the differences between the American approach and the dear old world approach that Guimard certainly would have been pushing at the moment. And we had obvious things. Le Monde was famous in Europe for going off and playing golf and eating ice cream and debating the undebatable myths of how racers should never eat ice cream and never enjoy themselves and essentially just do whatever their director said. And 7-Eleven, it was much more open. We had very good team doctor. Dr. Testa joined 7-Eleven at the very, well, when I came for the Tour of Italy in 1985, Dr. Testa was the sort of the underling doctor under some professor that wanted all the limelight. Well, that senior doctor took off after a few stages when he figured we weren't going to do very much, and then returned after Ron Kiefel won the 15th stage into Perugia, and Max came to say goodbye to us. And we said, no way, get rid of the old guy. We're only working with you. And I worked with Max every year of my career, and he's still with the sport. So there were a lot of myths that we would poo-paw, but working with Max all the years, I sort of understand a brash American reaction to all the myths of, don't eat ice cream, it's bad for your liver, and other things. He was very good at explaining, it's not that ice cream's bad for your liver, but if you're insisting on just eating whatever you want, when your body's absolutely exhausted doing a stage race, his point of view was Americans get pretty hung up, as everyone does, on their diet and being a rebel against sort of the simple, healthy Italian diet that he would not prescribe, but order for us from our restaurants and hotels. And he was very good at just explaining, look, your bodies are exhausted. For in Italy, it's no problem. If you're racing the Tour de France where the food's bad, you should eat the simplest food you can. It'll be easier for your exhausted GI tracts to take care of. And he was right. So as I progressed as a pro, I sort of dissected some of the myths that Americans were good at poo-pawing and adapting them with, eating ice cream whenever I wanted to eat ice cream, and certainly when I wasn't exhausted. But also learning how to eat white spaghetti with an omelet for breakfast before a big stage instead of a big bowl of cornflakes.
Interesting. So what I'm taking away from this is that I can eat gelato whenever I want, I think is what I just heard.
You can eat gelato all you want.
it's funny you say that. I mean, it's so true, though, being there. And I think, you know, I've never raced these events, but I've traveled with, I've embedded with the teams on, what, four tours and I think a Giro, a bunch of Dauphinés. You know, you the riders, I mean, you're staying in these little local hotels. And if it's a small town, it's a little small town hotel. And the food is, at least up until, you know, Team Sky with their mobile kitchen and these things, what you get is what you get. And, you know, and so I think that it's quite interesting. And we know that the baseline of food in Italy is much better than the baseline of food in France, I would say. It's certainly healthier, fresher, less fatty, all those things. So I guess, so it sounds like Max was helping you guys navigate that. I mean, were they literally ordering for you to help kind of take some of the, because the decision-making is stressful also, right?
The decision-making's already made is sort of the terrible inside track of certainly in the grand tours. Mm. Like in the, it's different now, but in the 80s, when I joined when I joined 7-Eleven for the 85 Tour of Italy, Hoonved was a co-sponsor. They make little washing machines for bars. Wonderful man owned it, and he paid $50,000 to the team, to 7-Eleven, to have Hoonved on the jersey. Well, $50,000 was the entry fee to the Giro, and that's pretty much the hotel bill. The major expense for the Giro d'Italia was taking care of the hotels of the teams. So we realized with Max on the team that the hotels had already had all their bookings. You know, if the 7-Eleven team had, I don't know, 15 rooms or whatever it was, the menu was already established, and it would be fish one night, you know, pasta, salad, all the other things. But the main course would be fish, chicken, steak, fish, chicken, steak, fish, chicken, steak is just what these hotels who are already paid ahead of time with vouchers from the Tour of Italy, who of course monopolize every hotel room in the area as part of the deal when they sign on with the town. They have to know that they have enough beds and they don't want to bicker over other people who gets which hotels. Well, Italian teams have a Rolodex. And if you're at the at a team presentation of the Giro d'Italia, you'll see the head soigneur in the background in one of the back seats. And as the race finishes and starts are announced, he'll be going through his old Rolodex, making notes of, okay, in that town, we love this 5-star hotel. We love this one 20 Ks away in this other town. Well, the American teams don't have that. So we're just given whatever leftover hotels they would be. And they would be the 1- and 2-star places, which, you know, isn't as good normally as 3- and 4-star places, but actually are better. They have better kitchens because it'll almost always be a family-run hotel doing grandma's recipes. So Max Testa, Dr. Testa, would call ahead and say, hey, you know, we're heading up to your nice mountain chalet. I've heard it's really nice. You know, I used to ski there when I was a kid. Instead of the fish that the race told you to serve us, you know, what would you be proud of to serve to the team? Because they'd always be psyched. You know, it'd be a modest little hotel. They were psyched to get any team. You know, a bunch of Americans, that sounds like fun. So they say, oh, yeah, you know, we could go get some fish for you guys, but looks like you're coming from Venice the night before. You're probably, you know, why don't you get fish there? And we'd love to cook, you know, this special pasta and, I don't know, deer meat or whatever they really, really were proud of. And also, it's pretty clever if you're trying to keep your emaciated little bike racers from getting food poisoning. It's pretty clever to figure out what you can order as a meal that'll be made fresh instead of maybe something at the bottom of the freezer. And I'm referring more to France than Italy,
right,
in that sentence, because that's more of a reality in France. So in Italy, it was really, really fun going to these small hotels as sort of the last team on the roster of the Giro d'Italia and meeting up with absolutely wonderful people who were delighted to have us, you know, and actually meeting the grandmothers in the kitchen who were serving us their family recipes. Oh, we ate well that year.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. Oh, I love that. I love that about it. Well, and so I think we'll get to this later, but I mean, that's basically the service that you're offering with your tour company.
Yeah.
It sounds like, right? I mean,
granny in the kitchen?
you're making me want to come ride with you in Italy and eat amazing grandma's amazing recipes.
And that's also something as a racer I really, really enjoyed was the hospitality in Italy. You know, being a foreigner, I spoke some Spanish and a little bit of French when I was racing in Italy. Speak perfectly because I'm too lazy to study Italian grammar, but I can yak all day with someone if it's about food or, I don't know, farming or roads or bike racing or, you know, usually food is the common subject. And it was very relaxing doing a pretty stressful job as a racer to be able to go out in the evening and just talk to kids or, you know, the old guys playing cards in the corner or the old ladies sitting in the park about what we ate that, you know, with the limited vocabulary, I could explain what I ate that night, ask if it's a local recipe, and they'd be off their rocker telling me all sorts of things about the local area. It was a good way to get over homesickness and just connect with the locals, which is, sorry, but that's Italy just over and over, especially when you get out of the cities or further south. People are just so delighted to have us visit. It was, you know, as a bike racer, we were many celebrities, even if they had no idea what our names were, because we you know, the whole town was having a big party with the Giro. So it was always an honor to be part of that party. But it's equally true to go as a traveler, especially on a bike, and say, oh, yeah, I rode here from, you know, these villages 100 kilometers away. Anyone sitting on a park bench in the evening is going to want to know about your route getting there.
Yeah, I love that. What are they? The slow, right? It's like the slow food, the slow, that way of life. I love, yeah, it's, you know, 8 p.m., everybody on the park benches chatting and happy to welcome the foreigner. And it's another world over
there. Yeah, which, you know, if I was a bike racer today, you know, it's so stressful. It's so hard for them, perhaps harder than what I raced. But I think I would rather go out, you know, be somewhere, go talk to people instead of stay in my room and play video games or read the grim news all day long. So it's interesting for me as a cycling fan to read about racing. But I keep screaming at my computer screen about when I read about the racers, you know, only being in the tour bus, in their buses, you know, I guess I would probably hide in them too. And you can take a shower there and you don't have to interact with people. But as a racer, I got so much out of, you know, sitting on the hood of a car at the start of the race where people were welcome to mill around. And in the evenings, just taking a short stroll and sitting somewhere and talking to people, because it gave me a feeling for what the people were like wherever we went. So I realize it's more chaotic at races now for racers, but it seems like there's a lot less contact with the environments people are racing in. And I think that would make it more stressful for me as a racer.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a different world. I think things are bigger. To me, like, I won't even go to the tour anymore. With the teams, you know, it's fun to be a fan on the roadside, but it's so stressful, the security and the navigating that. And I definitely understand that for the athletes, why they just kind of want to hide away, because it's, you know, it's just so much chaos.
Yeah.
And I would way rather go to the Giro, where it still feels a little bit like you're describing, right? It's just a little bit more relaxed.
Yeah.
You know, I think you still have some of the athletes, it's their choice if they want to stay on the bus. But, you know, if they did want to get off the bus and, you know, walk 100 feet, they can do it. Where I think any more at the tour, I mean, it's like they're prisoners in behind the Armco.
Yeah. It looks like a shark frenzy. Yeah.
But no, that's fascinating. So So obviously we're talking racing, we're talking Giro. We have to talk 88 Giro. I mean, this is the iconic photograph and the video. If for those who've seen it, we'll link to it below. But I mean, you in the snow, I think as cyclists, you know, we've all looked at that photo and thought like, I feel like I've done that once, you know, like I've been that cold.
A bunch of times, right? It's just you didn't have all these famous photographers. Yeah.
But I think that's I love that beautiful connection to the sport. Like I look at you and think like, I have some concept of how bad he's suffering right now. You know, when I watch Formula One racing, I don't know what that feels like. But so your mind on that day, I mean, I guess just kind of walk me through, what was happening there. I mean, obviously you guys are climbing, the weather's getting worse and worse. Like, what are you thinking? Like, oh my God, I'm going to freeze to death. Or
from the beginning, it wasn't going to be just any old stage. It was a short stage. I think 120 or 130 kilometers, but looking at all the stages in that edition of the Giro, and there were a lot of mountain stages because Francesco Moser was no longer racing. He was one of the race. He was helping the organizers. All the mountains that were missing during his era, like when I raced in 1985, were, you know, made up for, you know, let's find all the mountains we can. So the Gavia was put in with a stage finish in Bormio. And it had been done twice, I think in 60 and 61. So almost 30 years previously. And the profile, it looked really hard, but there's all the information you needed about grades. But Dr. Testa grew up in that area and he'd driven over the pass to go skiing or, you know, to visit, I guess it would be in the summer, to visit Bormio. And he said it was a very, very difficult road. It was dirt. It was one lane. It was 14%. The last 14 kilometers were very difficult, steep, narrow, dirt, you know, pretty cool stuff, things that I really like. And then a 25 kilometer descent that in good weather, you might think, well, you know, even if I lose a little bit of time on the uphill, that's a nice long descent, blah, 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 I'll catch back up. Well, it wasn't that easy. And I had the great advantage of having friends in Italy. And one of them was Johnny Motta, who won the 1966 Giro d'Italia, loves Americans. He and I love Volkswagen Bugs. I met him as an, you know, we were friends. We'd say hi at races. And he came up to me at the first stage or, you know, whatever we were doing for the prologue or before the prologue for the TV cameras. He came right up to me and said, Andy, you can win this Giro d'Italia. And you need to do it on the Gavia because I'm going, you know, I'm talking to all the other racers and their directors who are from my generation. I know all these people. Whenever I mention the Gavia, they poop on me and say, oh, bikes are so modern. They're so light. You know, they're like 9 kilos now. The racers are so much stronger. They have so many gears. The brakes are so good on these modern bikes that a mountain's a mountain. It doesn't matter if it's the Stelvio or the Gavia. They're all the same. The racers are going to blast over it. It's not going to be a big deal. He was saying that they're so wrong that, you know, he wasn't just being nice to me. He wasn't just angry at being ignored by these other people. He realized there was a really big disconnect with how the Italian teams were looking at that one particular mountain. And he told me to focus on it. And Mike Neal, my director, was right there and he was all ears. He's a sharp guy. So all along we were looking at, you know, it's 8 days to go. It's the beginning. There was a mountain stage, two mountain stages preceding it. But we thought, you know, this is great. There'll be a couple mountain stages to warm up on. It's short. It's not really brutal because there's only one huge, there are two mountains, you know, a first category and then whatever huge category you want to put on the Gavia. The Stelvio was the next day, so people would be timid about all these mountain days in a row. you know, let's really focus on this one day. So we did. But I won the uphill finish 2 days before it. So I was in flying form. Like, I just knew this is so good. I've been, my team's been shielding me all along. You know, I'm in fourth or fifth place. I'm just fine. I'm exactly where I want to be. But we wake up in the morning in a little, I think it was some sort of ski town at about 1,000 meters where we were sleeping. And it was snowing, but just huge wet flakes with slush all over. Like, it was a really nasty storm had come in. And I guess we would have seen a weather forecast. It would get wet, but it, I think it surprised a lot of people. It was the 5th of June and it was snowing. So the race was actually delayed. The start was delayed a little bit and we were going to cut out. We would have descended 600 meters down to the valley floor and then climbed the Tonale Pass, descended the Tonale Pass, and then turn at the town of Ponte di Legno to do the Gavia Pass, and then descend 25 kilometers to Bormio. So the race directors met with all the team managers that morning for an emergency meeting and said, look, we're, you know, we have the road crew on the phone, the pass is clear. They've been using snow blowers weeks ahead of when they normally open it. There's fresh snow falling on bare dirt or asphalt, depending on which section of road it was. The road's passable. It's no problem. You know, they'll run the plow 3 minutes before the first riders come through. It'll be passable. So nothing changed. Nothing should have changed. Some of the teams, especially the guy in the lead, he wanted to cancel it, or, you know, we could have done an alternate route around it, but this was bike racing up until this point. Things, unless the bridge was bombed or something, the race would always proceed. So I was excited for that stage already. I was deluded that it was snowing on my big day because, of course, in my mind's eye, there were sun was shining and I'd be kind of sweaty and the cameras would be rolling and I'd look beautiful when I rode away from everyone. And reality wasn't going to be that way. But we had a really good team meeting with the information that the weather would be absolutely awful. The storm was coming from the north, the direction we would be descending the Gavia. So we changed our tactics a little bit to put more emphasis than we would have on the descent. So I was going to ride the climb at 90-some percent, not 100, save enough energy to, you know, have my wits about me on the descent. And we would have, we always had two team cars with our clothing bags in them to follow us. But since it was a mountain and the team cars couldn't get to everyone, we each had a Musette bag of warm clothes that our manager, Jim Okowitz, would have for us 1 kilometer from the top. So no matter what, we knew on the climb up, we'd have warm clothes. We had a soigneur that had a thermos of hot sweet tea with 2 kilometers to go, 2 or 3 kilometers. You know, so we did all we could to prepare every rider, not just the leader, for the day. And other teams failed in almost all of those accounts. Which ends up being very interesting. So the race went off. A breakaway went with pretty good riders, but not the most worrisome riders on general classification. The Colnago Del Tongo team was doing tempo, controlling it for their race leader, Franco Chiocioli. And I was super happy to let that happen. Over the Tonale Pass, it was bucketing rain. So at the start, it wasn't freezing. It was raining, but we were down at a few hundred meters. And the Gavia Pass is 2,600 meters. And growing up in North Dakota, math wasn't my forte because everything's dead flat. You don't need to worry about it. But wind chill and temperature are some things I always focused on. So we knew it would be very, very cold at the top. We were absolutely soaking as soon as the gun went off. I had 2 rain jackets and leg warmers and arm warmers and booties and all the things I would ever want. We went over the Tonale Pass, which isn't as big, but it's a pretty hard pass with about a 10 or 12 kilometer descent. And I remember shaking so hard on the descent that I had to let go of the bars. I had to have my hands really loose around the bars so I wasn't going to vibrate off of my bike. And thinking, wow, this, you know, this is the easy mountain today. I'm in huge trouble. But the team was looking after me. Do you want more clothes? Do you want to get rid of clothes? I got a bottle every 5 minutes of really hot, really good hot sweet tea. And I just did what we bike racers do on the sort of a false flat while Del Tongo's chasing on the Tonale. So I just look at my competitors, and everyone was terrified. Everyone was just horrified and sort of sunken down into themselves, which I was doing at the same time. And you've probably been around bike racers long enough to know there's nothing to cheer us up like seeing other people more miserable than we are. And I just thought, all right, it's just, we're back to plan A. Just like the team meeting said, you know, I've just got to let loose, you know, not ignore the weather, but work with it. And then I got rid of all of my extra clothes. You know, my teammates brought things back to the car. I got rid of 20 pounds of soaking wet clothes, got down to bare legs, no shoe covers. I had a wool jersey because I was leading the combination jersey, a super thin polypro long sleeve undershirt, and Glacier gloves, neoprene kind of diving gloves. I think they're made for cycling by the Glacier Glove Company. So my hands would be warm. So getting my clothes at the top, you know, I knew from experience from all those other cold rides I've done that once your hands turn into claws and you can't really manipulate zippers and fasteners, then I wasn't going to be able to be warm for the descent. At that point, we went back to plan A, told the team, yeah, let's do it. They did, some, you know, pretty hard, but didn't have to do super hard tempo for me on, oh, there's 6 kilometers of climbing from Ponte de Legno that are, you know, 5 to 6% average. Just to get me at the front of the climb, all my competitors were right there. Then I thought, oh, geez, I'm kind of a sitting duck. I won 2 days before. I'm doing well in GC. You know, I have my team lined up. All my competitors know what I'm going to do. And we bike racers are supposed to be really clever and pretend we're feeling terrible when we're feeling good. And I just thought, nope, they're all looking at me. I can't wait for that road to turn to dirt. I hadn't seen the climb before, but Dr. Testa described exactly what it would be. There would be a sharp left-hand hairpin from a big, nice, modern, well-engineered two-lane road. It'll funnel down into a grove of larch trees, a kind of pine tree. It'll go down to one lane. It'll turn to dirt, and it'll be 14% right away. So I just thought, right, everyone knows this. I'm at the front. It's 14Ks to go. I'm just going to attack. I'm going to do 3 attacks, like really hard, super hard, and as hard as I can, and then chill out because it's a long way to go. It'll be broken up. There won't be much drafting. You know, all my competitors are super smart. Some of them are ahead of me. The others are really close. I'm not so worried about the breakaway, but I just want to do that climb. I don't really want to play games trying to drop people or worrying about them dropping me. I just want to get warm. I just want to go really hard, but not 100%. Probably hit the top with a little group. Put the warm clothes on before the top, and then I'm going to rate my race is the 25 kilometers of descending, and it worked well. I went hard enough on my first attack that I got away, and I like dirt. I didn't ride a lot of dirt, but in Colorado in the early 80s, I'd go out in the winter and just go back to dirt roads because I really liked them. There was really good traction. It's a really good dirt road. There weren't potholes or sharp rocks or obstacles that we needed to avoid. It turned to snow probably at the 1,000 meter or 1,200 elevation mark. So I was already soaking wet, so a little bit of snow instead of rain hitting me is not going to make any difference. I called up the team car with maybe 5 kilometers to go and put on a really good neck gaiter that I could pull up over my nose and ears for the descent, and a wool cycling hat. And when I did that, I shaved my hair, you know, just to get the water off of it. And on the first stroke, I felt a pile of snow roll down my back. And I thought, I am climbing, trying to produce heat. You know, I'm feeling pretty good, but it's much colder than I realized. And I focused, if focus is the right word, I was in a haze, but, you know, I managed to hold back and eat and drink a lot on the uphill, but I looked at the spectators, many of whom rode their bikes up there, and they were shivering and underdressed and wet, blah, 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 just like we racers were, but they were going crazy. You know, an Italian tifosi are pretty rabid anyway, but usually just because they want to cheer on their favorite. They were so into the fact that we were racing by. Because, you know, I was still catching racers from the breakaway ahead of me, so I could hear everyone being cheered for. And I was trying to analyze how cold these people were standing at the side of the road. And some of them, you know, were smart, and they brought a backpack with plenty of warm clothes. But I realized it was really, really, really cold out there. And also, it was a pretty special day. So I stuck with my plan to not go too hard over the top. And one of my primary competitors, Eric Breukink, caught me over the top. And there was, the top was paved for a little bit before it plummeted down back onto a dirt road. So he and I went over the top, and I made a real mistake. When I got my Musette bag, I was just going to take my plastic rain jacket and throw the rest of the things back to Jim Okowitz. But I was with Breukink, so I had to be cool because there were cameras on us now. And instead of stopping and throwing on this coat and zipping it up or doing the Velcro or whatever it had, I had to ride my bike like a pro, you know, trying to get my frozen, sticky diving gloves through the sleeves. So I sort of lost 30 seconds, and he caught up to me going over the top, and I thought, this is great. I'll follow him on the descent. He's from Holland. He'll, you know, I bet he rode his bike to school in the snow too. But he wasn't very comfortable in the snow when we started. There's quite a bit of flat or undulating near the top. We didn't start descending right away. And now the slushy snow was on pavement instead of a dirt road. So I thought, well, I'd rather make my own mistake than follow someone else's mistake. So I took over the lead. And I don't think I ever got very far behind him. And after a few kilometers of descending, I got cold. Like I had my head and face covered. I had that rain jacket on. My legs were bare. And I knew, you know, I knew I could probably go about 60 kilometers an hour average. So I have 25 minutes of descending. But I also knew about hypothermia and just how things get dim as that sets in. And I wasn't worried so much about my extremities, but I kept my legs turning. I just told myself, don't ever, ever stop pedaling. I was feathering the brakes most of the time. And it was a lot of, you know, it was like 2 or 3 inches of slushy snow on a really good road surface, a dirt road surface. Like I could test my brakes, or I could do a quick turn and feel there was good traction. So it didn't feel dangerous. But there were no lead cars, there were no lead motorcycles. My car, my team car, had bald tires. It couldn't follow me. I was on my own thinking this whole race was going on. But for the next 12 kilometers, it was snow, and then it changed to rain. And it's a crazy road with all sorts of turns, and then a really long straight, and then 3 left turns somehow before you hit a right. It's a really neat road to ride on in good weather. And when I came to the first town of Santa Catarina after 12 or 13 kilometers of descending, the snow turned to rain, the road was wider, and it was paved again. And the race director, his car showed up because he went to a cafe. There's no radio communication at this point because they relied on the same helicopters that their technology relied on the TV helicopter to relay the signal, apparently. So he was in a cafe and he made his driver stay outside and just, you know, when you see the rays come by, tell me and, you know, we'll follow them.
Let me know.
into Bormio. The rest of the race, I went as fast as I could. I don't know if I was going super fast or not. The next 10 kilometers of descending are straight and steady for the most part. There are no switchbacks. I've been there a lot in the summer. And I was going pretty fast, but Eric Breukink caught me and passed me with 7 kilometers to go. I felt like a ghost just came out of the blue, because at that point, I'm no longer thinking, go me, I'm winning the race, because I wasn't sure if there were people in the breakaway ahead of me or not, because the lead motorcycle wasn't giving me splits until maybe that time. Breukink passed me. I couldn't get on his wheel, but I could use him as a rabbit, and he finished 7 seconds ahead of me. He didn't have a rain jacket. He was a bit more aerodynamic. There's no way I'm throwing away my rain jacket at that point, because I'm probably going to fall off my bike doing it. You know, and I was probably going 60 to 70 kilometers an hour as fast as I dared through the wet curves. And, you know, a little bit disappointed when I crossed the finish line to be beaten by one of my rivals. But I figured, I knew at that point that I was second in the race. And there's little YouTube videos you can see from after the race where my team car followed me across the finish line. There are no barricades. And it's in Bormio. It's a little bit of an uphill finish. It's in front of there's a really big thermal bath center, and that's sort of the center of town. And the car just pulls over 50 meters later. No one's there. There's no crowd. There's no barricade. And they leave the engine running. They make sure I'm okay. And I'm in hysterics. Like, I'm not in a good place, but I'm super happy to still be alive. And they're just get in the car. You know, here's your clothes. You can get out of your wet clothes, put on your warm clothes. We'll keep the engine running, you know, with the heater going. And they come and check on me, and I'm still kind of freaked out, but I, you know, take the hot tea or whatever they give to me. And then I'm starting to warm up and think, okay, this is all right. You know, wonder how I did. So Mike Neal comes back again to check on me again. And now I'm mad that he's, you know, all this time has gone by, and I have no idea how I did against the other guys. And you said, Andy, no one else has crossed the finish line. It's been 5 minutes.
Wow.
So Breukink and I were fairly close, but third place was 5 or more minutes behind us. The team leader, Franco Chiocci, he did well. He was 9th or 10th on the stage, but 7 or 8 minutes back. So I ended up taking the leader's jersey. All I was thinking on that descent is get to the hotel and, you know, get somewhere warm, take a bath, get out of this nightmare. But at that point, I was pretty excited to slip on the pink jersey for the first time ever. And it was a great experience. You know, looking back, there's kind of an unofficial club of all the racers who did it. You know, each experience is valid. Mine is cool because I got to get second on the stage and take over the race lead. But everyone who did that stage has a story similar to mine, and they suffered as much as I did.
So yeah,
it's pretty fun after all these years to hear other people's stories.
Oh, that's cool. That's beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful stage. The images, it's one of the icons of cycling, I think, you know. Anyway, it's so cool to hear it firsthand.
Even though it's before the internet stage, and there's no film, there's some still camera shots from the top, but they couldn't film up and down. Poor Graham Watson, it was the last day he ever took off in his whole career. Like, he decided not to bring his cameras that day, his biggest professional regret. You know, other photographers were there.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, the poor guy. You know, so it's in the internet stage, there's not much material to look at from it, but there's really good stories. And, you know, in cycling lore, it's good fun. There was the argument the stage should have been canceled by people who lost time on it, but I don't agree with that because, you know, it was dangerous. Someone could have gotten hypothermia, but riders behind me stopped at the top, put on down jackets, put on all the clothes they wanted, and descended. And someone like Urs Froehlich, I've heard he crossed the top 30 minutes after me, but he crossed the finish line 20 minutes. Like he was warm. He went faster than I did on the downhill. And it certainly crossed my mind, and, you know, going on the way up, why am I doing this? This is horrible. This is horrible. It's like, well, I'm a bike racer. I can stop anytime I want. You know, there were no cafes or spectators on the downhill to get refuge from, but every rider had their choice. The interesting thing, one of the interesting things for me is I think it's the day that all teams came up with the rain bag policy. Because before, each team would have a bag of rain hats and rain jackets, maybe in a few different sizes. And when it started raining, riders would come back to the car and load up and distribute them to their teammates, or just take one if they were alone. And now if you want to have a fun interview with the rider, just say, hey, what's in your rain bag? And if it's, you know, if it's a hot race, they may not have one, but most races, they have Gore-Tex, they have gloves, they have hats, they have booties, leg warmers, arm warmers in their own personal bag, maybe a pair of spare shoes. And I think that's the moment that all teams realized, wow, we lost a lot by not being prepared with simple things like clothing. And 7-Eleven did a great job with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it highlights too. I mean, I think as a spectator and even as a racer, we think of bike racing as all the classic great stuff about bike racing, but there's the logistics that are going on in the back end are so critical, right? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you look at the war movie and it's all, you know, infantry shooting and all this stuff, but like somebody's got to move the food and the ammo and the, you know, and you look at an event like the Tour de France or the Giro, and it's the logistics to be successful on that scale are really impressive. And yeah, I think you're spot on. I mean, this was the beginning of the end of the old days of like, oh, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Our team meeting was the Swaneers came in and said, we went shopping. Every ski shop that was open, we bought anything that looked warm. So we had wool balaclavas, ski mittens, whatever you want. We were ready for that one day. And that was with three mechanics, three Swaneers, you know, one team doctor and a race director and a manager.
L'americano Amstin di Boulder in Colorado è riuscito a limitare il ritardo a soli 7 secondi. Quindi Andy Amstin è la nuova maglia rosa del Giro d'Italia.
As you can tell, there's a lot left for Andy and Josh to cover, so we are going to take a breather here after that stunning ascent and descent of the Gavia.
Oh, I'm so glad that they are going to be coming back and continue detailing this historic Giro and the rest of his career. So please be looking for that in a future episode. For now, we're going to wrap up with a reminder that we are alternating episodes like this one with our Ask Josh Anything shows, which of course is about your questions. And there are a lot of ways you can ask those questions. You can leave a comment on this or any episode at marginalgainspodcast.cc, and you can also call or text our hotline, 317-343-4506. One more time, because I said it fast, 317-343-4506. You can leave your questions, you can leave your comments at that number.
Yeah, Fatty trying to keep up with Andy as he was descending the Gavia there. So excuse him, he's a little worked up right now. As a reminder, this podcast can be found wherever you get your podcasts, like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And by the way, Spotify is a new way of ranking. So if you use Spotify, please rank us there. You'll find links to other ways to subscribe over at marginalgainspodcast.cc.
Everyone, thanks so much for listening. We will be back real soon with more Marginal Gains.